Thank you for being, and welcome to the Peniel Podcast. I'm Josh, and I know that I know nothing. So I created this podcast to help awaken my spirit.
Baron Sondel is a ski instructor at Keystone, Colorado. Co-host of the Crawdads and Taters podcast, he's a former Bernie 2020 Super Volunteer, Canvasser, Tech Sweeper, and National Delegate. His writing has been published in Military History Online, Due Dissidence, Dissident Voice, and Real Progressives. A member of the working class trying to create massive economic change in society by choosing to care and be active in the system.
Birian, thanks for joining me here today. I really appreciate you being with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I found you on Twitter, but I actually knew about you beforehand. I was a delegate for the Democratic Party up through the state assembly and the caucuses in Colorado. And then you wrote a letter to all of us to be elected to a national delegate. And that's how. And so then when I found you on Twitter, I was like, oh, it was that guy. And I had a horrible experience being a delegate for the Democratic Party and learning about the process here. And I was wondering if you might be willing to share how you felt about this past election and your experiences.
Yeah, so I had a horrible experience as well, and we have that in common. I mean, the whole process, this is the first time I've really gone through it. I mean, I went to the caucuses in 2016, but I was never a delegate of any sort. I don't know if you had previous experience with that or not.
I was a delegate in 2018, but it wasn't presidential, and so I realized I had an ability to communicate more directly for the people that were trying to get on the ballot. And so in some way, at least make them think or have direct conversations with them in a way that I don't normally have access. And so that's what I found beneficial. But then 2020 was a whole different monster.
Yeah, I mean, everything was a little bit different, especially with the COVID rearing its ugly head in the middle of the process, which I'll get to eventually. But I mean, for starters, the original county assembly was on a Saturday afternoon, which luckily I knew that and I was able to get off work. But, you know, I live up in Summit County and almost everyone works on Saturday, especially because it was like spring break. You know, I can't remember the exact date, but it was middle of March, late March, somewhere in there. I guess early March, because it was middle of March when COVID came around. But yeah, so everyone I knew, I tried to get people to come because I was like, you know, I'm going to be running for delegate. And I couldn't get any of my friends to come because they were all working because it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday. So then I get there and it's basically all old people because those are the only people who don't work. So right from the start, we had almost zero working class representation, as far as I could tell. You know, I think there were maybe 80 people at our county convention, which was nothing compared to 2016. And we had like several hundred people there easily. I think maybe 300 or 400. I don't know. It was a lot.
80 people is not a lot to make big decisions about where we're going as a country for an entire county.
No, I mean, we're talking county here, you know, trying to represent all the Democrats of the county, which is, you know, quite a few, more than 80.
Yeah.
I mean, I canvassed in the county and I mean, I think I talked to more than 80 people.
Did you believe that if we could have gotten a Bernie Sanders in, that the Democratic Party could have actually been a vehicle for change? Do you still believe that if you did?
I mean, that's a good question. My concern is that if we had actually gotten him in, they would have done something similar to what they did with McGovern and essentially refused to endorse him, refused to back him. You know, gotten together with the labor unions and like AFL-CIO was the only time they didn't endorse the Democratic candidate was with McGovern. So, I mean, considering how bought out the Democratic Party is, I don't know if Bernie even, you know, we like to think he would have won, but with the entire media, and if the the Democratic Party turned on him, I don't know if he could have won, actually, either.
Why do I feel like people who consider themselves to be Democrats think they're on, I guess, either side? It's not just Democrats, but whatever team someone is ascribing to, they think themselves better than the other side. There's this really division, and then an egoic step up, like, I'm a good person because I support this party. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, my way or the highway with both Democrats and Republicans. You know, it's, if you're not voting for my party, then you don't count. And I think a lot of that is the polarization that the media creates. You know, artificial divisions that they like to really push, you know, red versus blue, rather than having a real class-based working class versus the oligarchy, which is what it really should be, in my opinion. Because when it comes down to it, you know, I have more in common with a working class Trump voter than I do with, you know, any of these lobbyists who are pushing for the Democratic Party to not support Medicare for All or any of that. I talked to a working class person, and they're probably going to have complaints with the current healthcare system.
They're really good at obfuscating those points and getting us to focus on culture war and not being able to see past towards the class war.
Yeah, I'd say that sums it up pretty well. I mean, it's just another artificial divide. They like to do, they do the same thing with, you know, race. Basically, it's any kind of distraction to keep us from uniting together. You know, it's the whole 99% versus the 1% thing that Bernie liked to talk about. You know, 99% is a whole hell of a lot bigger than 1%, but we still can't seem to get anything done for the 99%, no matter whether it's, you know, blue or red in office.
Yeah. Do you think electoral politics is ever a vehicle for creating the type of change you're talking about?
Not in the United States. I mean, I see it's had some success in other countries where they have a little bit better of a system. I mean, right now I'm watching the results coming in from Peru, where Pedro Castillo is currently in the lead. And I believe at this point there's 97% of the votes in, so he's pretty sure that it's going to be successful. And you have the whole Bolivia, but then, you know, with these countries, once they get a leftist in, then the United States comes in and boots them out.
It seems like our system is very good at protecting itself.
Yeah, it's been designed, and they've really perfected their methods of, you know, voter suppression. I mean, we saw that in the primaries. Both 2016 and 2020.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So essentially, I mean, where you saw the longest lines in the Democratic primaries were in either mainly university districts, where the young people who were heavily favoring Bernie Sanders were voting. I mean, Texas was really awful because they closed so many polling places. I know some of that's due to Republican governors just suppressing the vote in general, but the Democrats didn't do anything to counteract that. And, you know, even in Colorado, which is a, you know, heavily Democratic state, we had the longest voting lines were all the campus locations in Denver. And it was 2-3 hour lines is what I was hearing from people on the ground there.
Yeah, and we're a vote-by-mail state, which is a lot better than, you know, most states. The lines here, I wasn't even aware of those. But at least we have the opportunity to get a ballot in advance and you know, put it in through that system. I think Oregon and Colorado with the mail-in voting is really, if you're wanting to increase voter participation, there's no reason every state shouldn't have, you know, as lax voting laws as possible, as encouraging voting laws as possible.
Yeah, I mean, everyone should be able to vote. I mean, that's theoretically what democracy is about, but in this country, there's all kinds of, you know, there's gerrymandering, there's, yeah.
Well, and then there's just people not representing the where they're coming from and instead representing big money. I think big money's stranglehold over the people that run our country permeates everything. And I think that's why, while I tried through the electoral politics system, and I still think there's some value to it, I'm starting to, you know, how can we make changes outside of it as well? Or what do we need to do to inject change into the system? Because even if we do elect the, you know, quote unquote, right people, you know, the squad were right people theoretically, and three of them just chose to vote present to allow increased Capitol Police funding. Whereas if they would have just voted against that bill, they wouldn't have been funding the police. They literally ran on defunding the police, and they're choosing to fund the police by their inaction. So, but weren't those the right people that they told us we should be getting in there?
Yeah, you know, like when ARC got in, she talked about how, you know, the first week of being a new member in Congress, there was just like getting talks from lobbyists. And I mean, that was good. She exposed that, but now she's, like you say, she was one of the three that voted present, I believe, on that bill. And she's had some pretty bad takes recently saying, you know, Biden's exceeded expectations. Like, it's like, that's not your job as a progressive. You need to be opposing the Biden agenda and saying, you know, where's the $15 minimum wage? What's this crap about the parliamentarian? Yeah, the parliamentarian doesn't run anything. Yeah. And
I remember when she was first elected, she staged, you know, participated in a protest with the Sunrise Movement in Nancy Pelosi's office. And I was so hopeful that she would continue in that spirit. But now, so funny, because I just pulled up an article you wrote today, Biden and the terrible, horrible, no good, no bad, well, very bad day, excuse me.
Yeah.
And Customs and Border Patrol used a helicopter. I was watching this live on Unicorn Riot the other day. There's a protest going on. Do you mind talking about it?
Sure. Yeah. So that's the Enbridge Line 3 protest, which would be one of the biggest, or possibly the biggest, tar sands pipeline. Tar sands is the dirtiest, ugliest way to extract fossil fuels. And this would be shipping, I don't know the exact number, but we're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of gallons of oil down and across sacred indigenous lands. And Biden has done nothing to stop this. He's done nothing to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. He did, you know, cancel the Keystone XL permit. And that seemed to be the only action he's going to take on any kind of pipelines and anything as far as, you know, fossil fuel extraction goes.
You mean other than approving more?
Well, yeah, yeah. The only like pro-environmental action that he's taken, other than, you know, he's rescinded some of Trump's executive orders. We've gotten maybe a little bit more regulation back, but when you listen to climate scientists, what they're saying is that we don't have time. Like, we need to keep it all in the ground. We need to move quickly on this. Like, and you don't do that when you have, you know, increased oil production. I mean, he signed into, it was like, I think 31 new oil permits within his first week of taking office. And yeah, where's AOC? Where's the squad on this? I know that Sunrise finally staged their first action, saying, you know, we can't wait any longer, but they waited 100 days. They should have been there on day one with Biden getting into office. I mean, we knew this was coming. He was arguing on the debates with Trump saying, no, we're not going to ban fracking. You know, when Trump's like, they're going to ban fracking. You're going to destroy all these oil jobs. And Biden's like, no, no, we're not going to ban fracking. I love oil jobs.
Yeah, it's another area where I fail to see the difference, especially in Colorado, which has so much energy production as well, but Democratic control. It's another area that I fail to see the difference between the two corporate parties. And then specifically, in addition to Biden's inaction on pro-climate legislation that could be done, or executive action, it's the way that the police state still oppresses unarmed peaceful protesters, whether it be pipelines, Black Lives Matter, whatever version of Occupy or economic fight is going on at the moment. And then, you know, a new one that I'm more familiar with now is animal rights organizations as well. They like to, the police like to terrorize, who are, you know, just trying to advocate for rights of animals. So how do you feel about the police state that we live in?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, there's a lot wrong with the police state. I mean, I support abolishing the police entirely.
What does that mean? What would that world look like?
So, I mean, we have to look at what is the root cause of crime, and primarily it's poverty. I mean, if you look at material crimes, it's like, I mean, look at George Floyd. Like, he was, you know, the police were called because he was trying to pass off theoretically a counterfeit bill. We don't know actually if there even was a counterfeit bill. That I don't think that ever even came out. But
it wouldn't justify murder, but sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, either way, it's like, so who's going to be looking to pass off a counterfeit bill? It's someone who needs to buy something badly. It's like, oh, okay. You know, even if they don't know it's a counterfeit bill, whatever. Like, poor person is going to be the people who are targeted by that kind of law. Like, Jeff Bezos isn't going to have counterfeit bills. I doubt he even uses bills. But like, anyway, so if we root out poverty, a lot of crimes are going to be gone. I mean, property crimes of most sorts. People robbing, like, why are people going to go into some break into someone's house and steal something? Well, they need money. You know, they need to steal a car. You probably need money, or they need transportation.
I think there's crimes of desperation. There's crimes of greed, because, you know, there's white collar crimes that are going on all around us as well, that are, they want money, but not necessarily need money. So I think the crimes of poverty you're talking about are more of desperation.
Yeah, exactly. And so these white collar crimes, the police don't respond to those. I mean, if someone is caught in a white collar crime, it's not your local traffic cop. It's not your state police who are showing up. You know, maybe they're going to call in them to help, but it's not going to be anything. You know, you don't have cops walking through gated communities policing. Yeah. I mean, I canvassed a lot in the Denver area. And there's a huge difference between richer communities and poorer communities in just the amount of police presence there. I mean, you're walking through, you see cops driving around in poor areas, and you don't see cop cars when you're in the more upper to middle class areas.
How do you feel when you see a cop?
Me personally, I mean, I don't feel personally threatened by them. I mean, I've got white privilege in that matter. When I see a cop, it's just kind of like, well, there's a cop. It's not the same reaction that someone, you know, person of color would have, I'm sure. Like I said, I don't feel they have much use. They're there to protect the private property of the ruling class. I mean, they're there to keep, you know, protesters in order. When things get out of, like, how many cops did we see during Black Lives Matter protests? That's more cops than we've seen in the rest of my life, that's for sure, at one time. I mean, I went to counter-protest of the alt-right gathering. I think it was right before the election in Denver last year. Maybe it was a little bit after. I can't remember the timing on that. that was right down there by the Capitol. And, you know, the entire alt-right group, they were surrounded by cops who were theoretically defending them from all these lefties who were counter-protesting. Just, there were hundreds of cops there. And for what? To defend the freedom of speech of these, like, racist Trump supporters who are out here. I mean, I don't understand why we needed hundreds of cops there. I mean, it's not like they weren't armed.
Well, but just to be clear, not every Trump supporter is racist, because I believe earlier you said that you have more in common with a working mm-hmm. class Trump supporter than, and so I just want to
rethrow
that out there.
I'm not trying to paint them all as the same, but I think, you know, the large majority that are going to show up to a, you know, white nationalist rally that's organized by Proud Boys are going to be, yeah, I mean, this wasn't just Trump rally. This was a protect the right. I can't remember the name of the guy who organized it, but he's from Colorado Springs, but like known white supremacist.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. And so, so you put yourself, it's them and then the cops and then you.
Yeah. And there was probably similar numbers of counter protesters to the people at the rally. I'd say, you know, maybe 100, 150 of each, and maybe about 100 cops too.
Do you find that to be an effective form of creating change? Do you think your being at that counter-protest was effective, or what were you hoping to achieve by being there?
Mainly just showing solidarity with the rest of the people who were there. I think it's important to have numbers to counter, you know, the message that's going out from these, like I say, from the right. Because if you didn't have counter protesters, you know, you wouldn't have the same kind of coverage. I mean, if the media is covering it at all, you know, and there's not people showing up saying we disagree with this message, then they're just going to cover the message of, you know, white supremacy and white nationalism.
I guess, or they don't cover it at all because there's a lack of conflict in the situation, so it doesn't make good news. I don't know the answer. I'm just probing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that once they hear something like a big gathering like this was happening, you know, the media is going to be there. You know, it's downtown Denver. It was announced, you know, weeks ahead of time, planned in advance. And, you know, they knew there was going to be these, I say, militia members, alt-right, white supremacists, whatever they call themselves. I think it was Proud Boys mostly that organized it, but there's, you know, multiple different militia groups, and they all have their own different takes on things. Like I said, I just feel like we need, you know, a voice on the left. We need to say that, you know, this is not okay. We accept everybody, regardless of the color of their skin. And that's not the message that I was getting from, you know, the alt-right.
Is that how you see yourself, a voice of the left? Have you always been on the left? How did you get here?
So I've always kind of leaned left. I haven't been, you know, throughout a lot of my life, I haven't been that politically active. But I've definitely been, you know, my parents are on the left. They're not wild communists like I am, but they've definitely always been more in the, you know, liberal to left side. But yeah, I've slowly, I guess I read Marx when I was like 19. And so that kind of helped with some radicalization there. It's like you read Capital and it's like, oh, this is just exploitation of the working class. And look at, and you know, back in his day, it was even worse. He's talking about 10, 12 hour work days, child labor, you know, the birth of the Industrial Revolution, where they decided that, oh, we can put these 8 year olds in the factory and we can be more productive that way. pay him a pittance and look at that, we can make money.
Seems like that's what we're trying to do with the, what's the Asian economic bill they're trying to pass right now? TPP. It seems like that's what they're trying to do with the TPP in Asian countries, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, that's what we saw with NAFTA. I mean, look at the conditions of the working class in Mexico before and after NAFTA. I mean, they just outsource it. And that's why something like, you know, $15 minimum wage bill is great. It's going to help people here, but it's just going to cause more outsourcing and more sweatshops in other countries. If they can't, you know, feel like they can't make enough profit, they can make profit at $15, but they can make more profit by starting another factory in Asia, like you say, and paying them, you know, $3 a day instead of $15 an hour.
Well, and not to mention $15 an hour is hardly enough to live on in this world as we have it set up as well, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's especially not, you know, look at Colorado here. We've got the median price of a house in Denver now is like $700,000. Up in Summit here, I think it just reached $1.2 million for a house. No one making $15 an hour is ever going to be able to afford to buy, you know, any kind of land, property, loan a house. Like,
what's the end result of that property consolidation then, of it not being transferred to different generations and a multitude of people?
It's just growth and inequality again. It's what we're seeing is out-of-state millionaires and billionaires are buying up property in Colorado now. And whether it's for second homes or whether they're going to become a new landlord class, it's just going to increase the amount of inequality across the country. And we're seeing that all throughout. It's not just Colorado. We're just one of the highest prices as far as land, you know, housing goes.
Seems like housing should be a human right, and it's not treated that way.
Yeah, I agree completely. And that's another issue that we have, you know, not just locally, but across the entire country. We have roughly 500,000 people every night are homeless, you know, don't have a shelter, whether, you know, maybe they're living in tents. We have tent cities all across Denver. You know, I drove past one every day getting to the Bernie office, and just see, I've been to a few homeless sweeps in Denver. Another reason why I'm not a big fan of the cops.
Could you explain what a homeless sweep is?
Yeah, so roughly every 2 weeks or so, they force the homeless to move. The city is definitely involved in this, and as well as the state. They're basically saying, you know, you can't stay in more than 2 weeks in one location. So then they put up notices about a week beforehand, you know, on like telephone poles in the area saying, you know, you have to be moved, but like, they don't have anyone to go to. And then the day of the sweep, they show up around 6 o'clock in the morning, kick everyone out of their tents, tell them to take their stuff and go, and whatever's left, they claim they're taking it to storage, but there's a giant garbage truck that they're throwing a lot of it into. But yeah, the claim is, oh yeah, this is going to be stored and you can go pick it up if like people are not, you know, if people are working. Homeless people do have jobs a lot of times. So there are some people there, you know, weren't there, and they're just, what happens? They come back and all their stuff's gone because the city took it. And who knows if, you know, these people are able to ever get it back, if it's been trashed, if it's taken to storage. I know it's, they said, from when I was talking to the workers there, they said they put it in storage for 30 days, but then storage, you know, it could be miles away wherever this storage location is. And yeah, the cops come in, they put tape up around the entire encampment, kick anyone out who's not, you know, currently living there. And then they proceed to tear down the encampment and kick all the residents out.
Why do you think it's so easy for us in society to devalue humans?
I think it's the system. I mean, the capitalist system is based on devaluing humans. And so it's kind of, people are taught, you know, it's the whole pick yourself up by your bootstraps sort of thing. It's like, oh, if it's people are homeless, it must be their own fault, not the fault of the system. It's kind of a cult of individuality that's especially prevalent in the United States. And I expect a lot of that has to do with our education system and the media propaganda. I haven't really looked into this too much, but I mean, that's kind of what people are taught.
Well, we value the individual over the collective.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, we have such a anti-communist agenda.
And we see individual success as the result of the individual instead of as a result of the system that helped bring the individual to the place where they're able to reach whatever successes they're at. Do you see that?
Yeah. I mean, you have the whole myth of the self-made billionaire. I like to use Bezos as an example because he's in the news a lot with, could be potentially the first trillionaire, apparently. I mean, who needs a trillion, let alone $1 billion? But people kind of ignore, you know, his parents had a emerald mine in, I think, South Africa. And he ended up getting a $250,000 loan from his parents to keep Amazon afloat when he first started it. So, I mean, there's nothing self-made about that. That was $250,000 of generational wealth coming down from his parents who were exploiting child labor in emerald mines. And then now he's still profiting off of exploiting his workforce.
Well, the number one way to get rich in this country is through generational wealth transfer. And never before in history has it been less likely for a movement amongst the classes, regardless of what you're doing. And I'm remembering, I don't remember what it's called exactly, but there was a science experiment and they set up a Monopoly game and started someone with more money. And almost every time that person ended up winning. And as the game went on and they were getting better, they would then change the way they were treating the person that was losing and think it was as a result of their better playing the game instead of result of them having started in a better position. Have you heard about that?
I'm not familiar with that experiment in particular, but I believe those results sound kind of like our entire society. I mean, interesting thing about Monopoly is it was originally created to kind of advocate for a more socialist kind of position. It was called the landlord's game, and there were two different sets of rules. And now we only play it by the capitalist set of rules, not the other set, which was supposed to be more egalitarian and kind of show, you know, how things could be more cooperative, I guess. But I've never actually tried playing with the original set of rules. Just an interesting little tidbit on Monopoly that I learned.
That was new to me.
Yeah, look up the landlord's game. That was what it was originally called. And it was kind of like a teaching tool to show, like, well, in this one system, you know, one person ends up winning and having everything. Well, in this system, everyone ends up winning.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine why our system wouldn't want us learning how to play that game.
Yeah, then it became, you know, Monopoly and like capitalism's poster child. Buy up all the property and then charge rent and take all the money and buy all the property from all your friends and then you get to win.
This reminds me, and there were these three kids in some village in Africa, and there was an explanation. They all started at the same line. And it was whoever runs to that tree first and gets there first gets all this fruit. And there was a bunch of fruit at the end. And like they said, go. And all the kids grabbed hands and they all walked to the tree together. And the person that did that test said, why did you do that? And they said Ubuntu, which means I am because you are. Have you heard about that? Or does that make?
I've heard of Ubuntu. I haven't heard of that particular test, like you said, but I mean, I think that's awesome to hear that. And it also kind of shows, you know, like, you know, we have competitions kind of built into our school system here. And obviously that's not the kind of education they're getting there in Africa. Like, I can even imagine that happening if you go to a bunch of school kids in the United States, whether they're first graders, second graders, kindergartners, even like, oh, we've got a bunch of fruit and probably candy in the U.S. because, you know, they might not actually be that interested in fruit.
Right.
But if you've got someone like, you get candy if you win this race, then, oh, they're just going to all take off. That's...
I could never imagine it going down like a hand-holding fest of kids walking to the tree together. I can't, when I heard that, my mind couldn't even conceive of an American child like doing that.
And I could potentially seeing, you know, the winner maybe sharing a little bit if there was a lot of candy.
Right.
Because we do try to teach sharing, but kind of.
I think it's like almost like charity from rich people. Is it really charity in the system that we have? It certainly doesn't provide for everyone. It's not enough to provide. And then, you know, charity in this country is really just an excuse for a tax deduction and less of an act of giving. And then when one has too much, is it in fact charity when one takes too much?
I mean, it's not really at this point, yeah, like you say, charity. It's more marketing. I mean, tax breaks and marketing. It's like Bill Gates doesn't want to be seen as an evil person, so he starts a foundation of charitable giving and talks about how he's going to give away all of his fortune. I think, did he say all of his fortune? I can't read, you know, a significant amount of his fortune before he dies. But somehow his wealth just keeps increasing no matter how much he is giving to charity. You know, and his charitable foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, is one of the biggest in the world. It's well funded, and I'm sure it has done some good. But I also wonder, you know, if how many people are just making money off of the charity at this point and how much of it is actually going, you know, to people who actually need it. I mean, Bill Gates has so much money, like the estimates of what it would take to end world hunger are less than what Bill Gates has. And why haven't we ended world hunger if he's really that interested in charity?
I
don't have an answer to this.
So why do you think we conform to this system?
Like I say, I think it's a lot of it is really education propaganda. It's ingrained. I mean, there's people have been taught to fight against their own class interests. I know people can say, you know, that I have more in common working class Trump voters, but they're still firmly believe in Trump and that he was going to help them, when we know in reality all he did was give tax breaks to the ultra wealthy.
Which Joe Biden is going to keep in place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Which, you know, that's the same thing with the Democrats. You know, we've got libertarians out there who, you know, absolutely believe that, you know, hard work is the only way you're ever going to get forward in this country. And if you work hard enough, they're going to be millionaires. Like, well, you know, the hardest working people in this country are actually illegal immigrants, and they're never going to be millionaires.
Yeah, the exploited workers are the hardest working.
Yeah, as far as, you know, the hardest amount of work, these jobs that no one else wants to do, they're the ones who are being the most exploited for their labor. I was like, it's not hard work that gets you ahead, but this is the kind of American myth in the United States, at least, is, you know, work hard enough, put your head down to the grindstone, keep working, and maybe you can also achieve the American dream and be a self-made millionaire.
And then when you get there, you look down on everyone else. Why do you think we do that?
I really don't know. I don't feel like people should ever have any reason to look down on others just because they're in a position of privilege. That kind of thinking is, you know, it's just not something that I can understand.
I think coming from privilege, we have certain blinders to that's with the self-made man, they know, you know, they would have to come, like, not the transfer of wealth Bezos Trump model, but you know, worked at McDonald's and worked his way all the way up and then became a CEO of some other company. And then, you know, started, mm-hmm. You would think, I don't know. It feels like the greed and the ambition always leads to a looking down on other people. Like, if that is the motivation that brings you up there, and that is a lot of the times, it's the motivation for the way people vote and the motivation for the way people live. It's based on greed and ambition. If that's the basis, I can only see that a rising up of your class would then allow you to think it's because you're better than.
Yeah, I think that's a good analysis. You know, and I think that's what we get when the system is particularly designed to reward greed. You say it's, you know, these companies, these corporations, you know, these CEOs, you've got like Dan Price, who cut his own salary to $70,000 a year and agreed to pay the rest of his workers the same salary as himself. But he's an exception here. You know, we've got everywhere, it's like, you know, they could afford to pay $15 an hour. They could afford to pay $25 an hour. Yeah. Amazon only increased their wage to $15 an hour after massive amounts of pressure coming from Bernie Sanders with the great, you know, the Stop Bezos bill, and which the bill didn't go through, but the pressure, their public image managed to finally get them to agree to a $15 minimum wage, which, like we discussed earlier, is not great, but it's something. But it's like, if they actually, you know, cared about their workers, they could pay huge amounts more. But when greed, you know, the system says, no, everything in the bottom line has to be about profit. You've got all these people who get their, you know, economics degrees, and they learn, you know, profit, 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 maximize your profit margins, rather than stop exploiting your workers and treat everyone like a decent human being. Then you end up with them thinking, oh, well, the workers are just a commodity as well. They're a tool. And so if we can cut corners and pay less and give them less benefits, then we should do it, because profit is the ultimate motive. And
maximization of shareholder wealth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's where the greed comes in. You know, it's like, we're rewarding greedy behavior rather than, you know, punishing people for being too greedy and letting other people starve.
Well, and it makes me wonder why I didn't learn about modern monetary theory in my macroeconomic course in college.
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, why, why didn't we learn about Marx in school? Marxist economics. Like, why don't we know about the value of labor and the surplus value that's being extracted every time you go to work?
Yeah, it starts when we're children, when we teach this model of competition instead of holding hands to walk to the tree and share, running to the tree to get the candy and maybe giving a little bit as charity while you, you know, think that you're better than because you got to the tree first. And then it goes all the way through, like, in my macroeconomic course. Yeah, I never learned about Marx. I never learned about modern monetary theory. I had to go find this stuff later. And you really have to go dive deep, because it's not like you're going to find any of this information on mainstream corporate owned media as well.
No, and they don't cover any of that. I mean, I learned about modern monetary theory because Stephanie Kelton was Bernie's economics advisor. And then if you actually look into what she's done, you know, she's one of the biggest proponents of modern monetary theory, and she started out not believing it either. He's like, no, there's no way, you know, the government has to pay for everything somehow. We have to raise taxes to pay for everything. And then she actually looked into it and was like, oh, wait a minute, that's not how this actually works. And, you know, she had an economics degree when she started doing that. Like,
I was always so amazed when I heard Alan Watts in a recording years before, basically use this analogy, which I think describes modern monetary theory very well. And maybe you've heard it. It's like we're trying to build a house, and we have all the workers and we have all the raw materials, and the foreman comes to the job today and says, sorry, boys, we can't work. And they said, why? And he said, we're out of inches. We can't work because we're out of inches. What do you mean we're out of inches? We got everything we need right here. I'm sorry, we're out of inches. We're out of that unit of measurement that allows us to do this and provide these things that we have available. Have you heard that before?
Not that exact analogy, but yeah, and that's, I think Stephanie uses the scoreboard analogy in her, in the deficit myth, where it's like, you know, kind of the same thing. Like if you're playing basketball, you know, one team keeps scoring, the score can keep going up. The score doesn't come from a, it's like, we don't have to pull the score from some other pool and there's no magical score limit. It's like, the score just keeps happening. It's just a scoreboard. You just add score. It's just there. It's digital currency. Like, and the kind of, that's what Congress does. It's keeping score when it creates money. And currently with our current system, they're creating money for the millionaires and the billionaires and not for the working class, which is why you say, it's like the resources, you know, we have the resources to house everybody. We have the resources for Medicare for all. You know, the government pays for your medical bills. Like, it wouldn't be that difficult. You know, we might need to get some more doctors to decrease wait times, but right now it's like, you know, we have a class-based medical system. If you can't pay for it, if you can't afford it, you're not going to get treatment, which is why we see a great disparity in, you know, the greatest way to tell, you know, how long someone's going to live is based on their income. I think there's almost like a 13-year gap between the top 1% and the bottom, life expectancy-wise.
So it seems to me when it comes to getting Medicare for all, it's never going to happen through either of these political parties. And I see on your Twitter that you say you're DSA. And I was really disappointed during the Force the Vote. And for anyone that doesn't know what that is, it was a pressure campaign to basically withhold the vote for Nancy Pelosi or at any time going forward, since the progressives, quote unquote, progressives in Congress theoretically could be just like the Tea Party and refuse to vote on anything unless we bring Medicare for all for a floor vote. And it seems like there is a genuine not caring of putting that forth, a lack of caring about it, when really this making sure people are taken care of when they're sick should be the most basic function of a society, don't you think?
Yeah, and there was, you know, like I said, there's a little bit of hope when Bernie was running, and he's done a huge amount to at least popularize the issue. I know, you know, polls show that more than half of U.S. citizens support government health care, whether it's called Medicare for All or not, whatever, universal health care system, like more than half, this includes Republicans, actually support a Medicare for All type system, single payer government funded health care. You know, this is, it makes sense. The other, I think it's 33 industrialized countries, they all have it. And the US is the only one out of them, and it ranks 33 out of 33, whatever, you know, whatever those numbers are, and as far as healthcare provisions go, like we're at the bottom because we have privatized healthcare. And
how did you feel about DSA coming out against Force the Vote?
Yeah, not a fan of that. I mean, there's like, AOC was talking about Force the Vote back in 2016 when she was first installed. You know, it was like, oh, we can bring Medicare for All for a floor vote, and then we can get people at least, you know, down with what they, whether they support it in a vote or not. You know, I'd also don't trust that they would actually vote the way,
of course,
they
not
actually believe.
But we might get a public pressure campaign that could be like nothing we've ever seen before. How amazing would it be if we could mobilize with the working class Trump supporter to get a system that provides health care for everybody?
Yeah. And actually, you know, as Bernie delegates, we actually did a poll of all the delegates, including Biden. And, you know, it wasn't a huge sampling, but I think we ended up reaching maybe 10, 15% of the delegates. And we found that even among Biden delegates, there was large support for Medicare for All. And these are, you know, people who supported a candidate who does not support Medicare for All. And even they're like, yeah, we need healthcare. It's like, this is a popular thing. The only people who don't support it are essentially the health insurance lobby that owns our government. And I don't understand why DSA would oppose getting a floor vote on that. I mean, force the vote. Personally, I was in favor of force the vote. I thought they should actually never vote for Nancy Pelosi, no matter whether she agreed to have a vote on Medicare for All or not, because Nancy Pelosi is absolutely awful. And my feeling was that, you know, they should just keep on voting no until they get someone other than Nancy Pelosi. Even if it was theoretically, you know, they'd say, oh, it'll just be another establishment, run-of-the-mill centrist Democrat. It's like, I don't care. They don't have the same kind of sway that Pelosi has. We'd be better able to push another speaker left. We're never going to push Pelosi anywhere. If you get someone new in there who doesn't have the same connections as Pelosi, I mean, it would still be, just getting rid of Pelosi would have been a victory, no matter who they replaced her with.
Yeah, well, when you look at it from the left, we didn't advocate strongly enough to make change when it comes to $15 minimum wage. We haven't talked about Medicare for All since the election. We haven't canceled any student loan debt. We haven't ended any wars. We haven't stopped deporting people. We haven't gotten kids out of cages. I'm failing to see, I guess what makes me struggle is I always fail to see the difference between the two parties, but everyone that associates with one of them really sees themselves as different from the other. And, but when I break it down like that, how do you feel about what I just said?
I agree. Yeah. Like if you look at policies, they're very, very little difference. If you look at performative actions, then there's a lot of difference. Like, you know, the Democrats say Black Lives Matter, but they don't actually do anything about it. You know, they say, you know, the right things when it comes to like standing up for LGBTQ, you know, standing up for trans people, trans rights, like, great. Yeah, that's, you know, that's the biggest difference that I see between the two parties.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Raytheon changed their symbol for Pride Month, and it's rainbow. You know, so even military industrial complex can be, you know, pro Pride.
It's like I say, it's mostly performative, you know, and it's nice to have, you know, representation for other groups. But if your representation for the gay community is Pete Buttigieg, is that really progress? I don't really see that as being great for anybody.
So that was one that I had a lot of centrist Democrat friends in Chicago that really seemed to like Pete Buttigieg. And I couldn't understand why. It seems like a lot of people actually enjoy the platitudes and the lack of substantive policy. Like they really just want to feel warm and fuzzy and could care less about what that actually means if they're already comfortable in their own life.
Yeah, that's accurate. That's probably, you just described the typical Pete Buttigieg supporter. I mean, he was groomed for the position. Yeah, he was well-spoken. He's, you know, went to Harvard, claims to speak all these different languages, although from what I've heard, apparently that's not actually so much the case as actually being fluent in these languages. But it's like, oh, he's smart. He's well-spoken. He could be the next Obama. He's gay. He's not Black, but he's gay. We could have a gay president. That's cool. We got, you know, representation. Wouldn't that be great? So he ticks all the boxes as far as the establishment goes on, like, you know, performative politics, like I say. It's,
well, because they have strength in capitalizing on those divisions. I think that's what it is. It's it's enforcing those divisions and showing how we're different that allows them to keep us apart.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, Cornel West has talked about Obama as being, you know, the worst of the Black bourgeoisie. it's like, well, we got a black president, but then he gets into office and he doesn't actually improve the material conditions of black people or other minorities. You know, he became the deporter in chief. He deported more people than any other administration, more than Trump even. You know.
We're easily distracted in America. Most people would care not to pay attention. And honestly, I've turned on the like an NBC News for a couple minutes just to see what goes on there. And it's in such a quick 2-minute bit that you couldn't possibly get any substance. Not that they're providing any truth on a mainstream corporate owned media station anyways, but it's enough to feel like you think you're informed, but not actually be informed. Do you feel like that from corporate media?
Yeah, I don't really watch much corporate media. I never really have. My parents didn't have a TV growing up, so that might have helped with me not being as brainwashed. But you know, from what I've seen of it, like watching the debate coverage during the primaries, like I definitely watched a lot more stuff then because I was closely following things and seeing, you know, the way they treated Bernie. And, you know, Bernie is not far left. By any standard, Bernie is pretty much just a centrist. If you look at other countries, it's like he's advocating for universal health care. Oh, well, other countries already have that. Even their conservatives are supporting their health care. Like, they can't criticize their health care system because they would never win an office in any other country if they're like, oh, I'm going to come in and privatize our healthcare and tear everything down and make it so you have to pay for it. It's like, that's not a winning strategy in any other country. So it's like, here's Bernie advocating for a mainstream idea in what is pretty much the rest of the world. It's like, but then we look at what our media does here and they acted like Bernie was the second coming of Hitler. When Chris Matthews actually compared Bernie's victory in Nevada to Hitler taking Poland. And he actually lost his job for that, which was good, but
his job at MSNBC, just to be clear for anyone who's not familiar.
Yeah, he was MSNBC commentator, pundit, whatever. But then they still have, you know, the rest of them were saying things almost as bad, just not openly comparing the only Jewish candidate to Nazis. It's like, oh, they went to one step too far, but it's okay if we just pan Bernie as being completely unrealistic with the rest of them. We'll keep our jobs. We'll just have one sacrificial guy who went a little bit too far.
Yeah, well,
and that's what the corporate media is. They're just manufacturing consent for big business.
Big pharma, big oil, big agriculture. Who else can pay for commercials?
Well, yeah, I mean, look who advertises on them. And then also look who owns, you know, I think it's six companies own 90% of the media in the United States. It's big corporations like Disney, who also treats their workers terribly. They're not interested in having a somewhat left populist in Bernie Sanders who supports some socialist policies that would actually improve the lots for everybody and would actually, you know, raise taxes on the rich. No, we're not interested in that. You know, the Trump tax cuts would have been gone under a Bernie presidency. We can at least believe that.
So I think it's hard, going back to modern monetary theory for a second, I think it's so destructive that people actually think that federal taxes pay for federal spending. And so I do think one of the best ways to make someone change their thinking is to tear down that understanding, which is so built in that like our federal government operates as a household budget, which it does not. Do you think that we need to confront people on whatever side of the spectrum about their, I'm not against taxing the rich. I just think we need to decouple that understanding from paying for things.
I agree. Yeah, completely. Like people need to understand that the federal government does not pay for anything with federal taxes. And that's a big thing. That's like, if people understood that, they would and realize that Congress is doing absolutely nothing. It's like they're arguing, oh, how are we going to pay for it? They're always trying to get these pay-fors into these bills. And then they're like, oh, no, we can't raise taxes. I can't support that bill because we're going to raise taxes to pay for it. And it's like, no, this is a bunch of, like, no one needs to pay for it. The federal government creates the money. They're Congress. They should know. You know, I think a lot of them do actually know that, but they're still using it as an excuse.
Why do you think that is?
That's because their lobbyists, you know, their own campaigns are funded by people who it's advantageous to believe that raising taxes funds everything. And it's like, no, we can't pay for that because we'd raise taxes. And the same people who are paying, you know, bankrolling all of these senators and congressmen's runs would not like it if their taxes were raised because that cuts into their profit margins.
And yet I find that normal working class people will say, I don't want my taxes to go up.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we definitely shouldn't want our taxes to go up. I mean, working class already are paying far higher taxes than anyone in the top 1%. There was just a report came out showing it was like all these billionaires, Warren Buffett, Bezos, Bill Gates, they're paying effective tax rate of like 1.2%, 1%. Like, and that, like, what? Like, when I think, you know, the lowest tax bracket is like around 20%. I think it's like 20 to 30% is what you're kind of talking about when you're talking working class taxes.
Right. And so we need to tax them to control their power within the system, but we don't need to tax them in order to pay for anything we're talking about, like delivering people healthcare or housing or education, nutritious food or clean water. I actually think those are the basics, and a state's inability to provide for those five things, it means it's failed.
Yeah, and by any of the standards, the United States is a failed state because it doesn't provide, you know, any of those things. I mean, clean water. What Flint, Michigan is the one that's used as the poster child for dirty water, but it's not the only one by far. You know, the Navajo Nation doesn't have clean water. Go anywhere, like South Carolina has terrible issues. You know, tons of neighborhoods. I think talking fracking earlier, Colorado is in danger of, our water supply is definitely in danger with all the fracking going on, even with all the forest fires going on that have been destroying our soil and getting all that into the water table. I mean, there's clean water is a huge issue and we can't even address that.
Well, and then I guess clean air is what I also left off, because when you bring up fracking, I think of the methane emissions and all the other chemicals that are spit off from there, and the energy production in the Front Range in general, and the population growth and an inability to build public transportation to support the population growth. So I'm actually moving to Oregon at the end of the month, and I've been in Colorado for 7 years. And the cleaner air quality is one of the reasons I'm most excited to be leaving.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Because, yeah, you live in the Front Range, right?
Yeah, I'm down in Boulder.
Yeah, and the air quality, I recently saw something saying, you know, it's some of the worst air quality in the country, the Front Range, especially the Denver-Boulder area. And, you know, a lot of that is due to fracking. A lot of the mainstream media won't even bother to make that connection. It's like, oh, we've got bad air quality. Maybe people should drive their cars less. Well, that's one thing, but how about banning fracking?
Why do you think Joe Biden's more likely to ban menthol cigarettes than he is fracking?
That one actually perplexes me on why he banned menthol cigarettes. That was very confusing. I feel like it was a racist thing to do for some reason, but I'm not sure why. I feel like class and race comes into that. But the logic behind Do you know what the official explanation even was on that? I didn't follow it too closely.
I am not sure. It makes me think about the South Park where they're selling all the flavored vaporizer pens to all the kids, and it's the nanny state. It's a continuation of the drug war and a restriction on our civil liberties. And I am not pro tobacco in any way, shape, or form, but I am also not for restricting one's ability to use any substance whatsoever they choose in our society.
Well, good thing you're moving to Oregon then.
It is, isn't it?
They're very progressive in that regard, at least. I know they legalized the psilocybin, and basically they're moving in the right direction there.
I moved to Colorado in 2014, and I had planned to move here before legalization passed, but that's when cannabis was legalized. Same thing. I was planning to move to Oregon, and then that vote happened. And so it seems like I'm just following the right wave of making us free of the drug war. Eventually, baby steps. We can't just, you know, let people out of prison and allow them to use substances freely in our society, so long as they're not harming anyone. That would be bad for the police and prison state.
Yeah, I mean, Portugal did it and it worked great, but we can't follow their example. And, you know, Biden is one of the architects of the drug war.
Aren't I a bad person for wanting the freedom to use substances?
No, I mean, I don't think... It's just weird that anyone would oppose that in my mind. Like, this is about individual freedom, and they are all like, we're about the cult of the individual here, but then no, individuals shouldn't be allowed to use drugs in the safety of their own home if they don't want to. Wait, what?
It's actually where I find a lot of agreement with libertarians is with respect to the drug war and then with respect to war in general. And that is where I think, you know, not just the 99% versus the 1% in a class uniting, but in a left-right divide, it's not, you know, you go far enough left and far enough right, and it's at the same place when it comes to civil liberties.
On a few things, they do meet up. But as far as like, you know, if you're thinking like horseshoe theory, that's not quite the same.
I don't know what I'm thinking. I think I'm just thinking we have more in common with each other than we like to think when we reinforce the divisions mm-hmm. that our society sets up.
Yeah, and I agree on that. Like I said, you know, the working class has a lot more in common than we realize. Then so much of that about the drug war is just designed to enrich the prison industrial complex and enforce the police state and to keep those racial divisions going. I mean, when they're talking drug war, you know, what are the rates of marijuana use? Oh, they're the same between whites and blacks and Latino. Yeah. Doesn't matter what color you are. The drug rates, usage rates are about the same. There are some differences, like the sentencing for like using crack cocaine versus powder cocaine is completely different. And it just so happens that, you know, rich white people use powder cocaine, whereas poor colored people are more likely to use crack cocaine. But as far as usage rates go, very similar across the board. But then when you come to incarceration rates, weird. It's all minorities that were getting arrested for having marijuana.
So what do you think is the most effective way that we can communicate our shared goals with each other that we clearly have with the 99% of us, even though these divisions are highlighted within our society?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I wish I had a rock solid answer on it, but when we're fighting this much propaganda, it's very difficult. I mean, it's, you know, you can spread the message on social media, you can talk to people, you know, the more we talk to people, the better. You know, that makes a difference just talking to our peer groups, talking to anyone really. But it's very hard to get this message out on a broad scale, which is why something like the Bernie campaign was so important, because he actually did get national media attention. He did bring these issues to the forefront, even if in the end he caved and just ended up supporting Biden. At least we got the message out, and there was some talk of, you know, a little bit of talk of class distinctions. There was a raising in class consciousness. You know, people did learn that, oh, Medicare for All is actually a feasible, you know, something that other countries have.
I think he created somewhat of a political awakening in a class of people who hadn't been open to those ideas before, and then took all that energy and squandered it within a counter-revolutionary party.
That's accurate. I'd say, yes. I think, you know, after 2016, when it was a clearly rigged primary, when the delegates walked out, I believe he should have joined them and started a new party at that point. And I think that could have really revolutionized the political system, broken up the corporate duopoly that we seem to be just stuck in, beating our heads against over and over again, and perhaps actually made a viable path forward in electoral politics. But without that kind of a break, I don't see a huge opening on the electoral front. Like, I think third party efforts are good. Yeah, I definitely, you know, vote third party whenever that's an option. And, you know, like you say, even libertarians, I think they're correct to vote for the third party and not to cave in and vote for either of the parties, even though I disagree with libertarians on a lot of things. I support them on their support of a third party and agree they should have that ability to express themselves on the ballot line. Whereas both parties now, they're trying to crack down on even allowing third parties to have ballot access. You say, you know, I don't think a third party is going to win, but I believe they should have every option to be there, to be able to campaign. You know, they should be on the ballot. That's like the very minimum for a democracy, is allowing, you know, different viewpoints to be heard.
Why do you think it's so easy for us to fall into lesser evil thinking when in reality, lesser evil thinking still gets us evil and is not going to get us progress?
I think that's another thing that's kind of been ingrained into our culture, is that, you know, there are only two parties, you only vote for two parties, and then the whole concept of the spoiler vote has been pushed. And that's also just...
And ranked choice voting would be a solution to that, which both corporate parties don't want to advocate for because they realize that might be the end to them.
Yeah, ranked choice voting is something we definitely need to be pushing for. I know a few states have it, a few localities have it. I think didn't Boulder just pass ranked choice voting for his mayoral elections, at least?
It's for the mayor. And I believe previous to that, I think the city council just chose the mayor. I don't even think we got to vote on the mayor.
So you didn't even get to vote on the mayor before that.
Yeah, yeah. So, I'm pretty sure that's how it was. I would have to double check, but I'm going to leave this in there regardless. But yeah.
Yeah, ranked choice and proportional representation are two things that I think any democracy needs. And they're two things that the United States doesn't have. And it's been kind of designed that way to make sure that the people actually don't have a say in things. I think you can go back even to like the, you know, the founders even were talking about making sure that the people don't have that big of a say. I think it's in the Federalist Papers somewhere in there, you find it where they're like, well, we need to counteract any kind of populist revolution. And that's why we have things like the Electoral College.
See, I look at COVID over the past year, and what I see from it, other than another infringement on our civil liberties like the Patriot Act, is an ability to massively restructure society almost immediately given the proper stimulus. And then I also, during the Black Lives Matter protests, Colorado passed one of the biggest police reform bills very quickly. And so either people in the streets or some other stimulus can create change, whether it's the right change or enough change, you know. But I am encouraged by our ability to create it. And I think that's what we need to highlight from it. Do you see that?
I mean, when it comes down to it, like it says, the people do have power. It's just been very diminished in the system. But if you get enough people who are willing to stand up and get out in the streets and push for real change, then yes, it can happen. The problem was with the, like the Black Lives Matter protests, is they kind of petered out. We didn't get enough change from that. There wasn't enough focus on actually enacting change. There was a little bit of a lack of direction on that.
Well, it's tough. It's the desire to be decentralized and a leaderless movement like Occupy was, and at the same time, then that leading to a lack of organizational demands and way to communicate and facilitate that.
Yeah, so like the Movement for Black Lives, they have very clear demands. They have the BREATHE Act. Actually, they've written an entire like act that includes most of these demands, but then it was unable to translate into actual action as the kind of the protest movement died down. And there was, like you say, decentralized leadership. And that's another thing I don't have a full answer to, because it's like, if you have centralized leadership, then they can either be co-opted or targeted by the state apparatus. But if you have decentralized leadership and you don't have enough real focus, then you're also going to see what we just saw. So, I mean, the solution moving forward is very clear demands from any kind of protest, any kind of action. Like we're talking about the Sunrise Movement. I wish they'd be more into direct action and they, you know, continue pushing with occupying Pelosi's office. It's like, well, that was a one-time action. It didn't go anywhere. Why didn't we continue with that? Why don't we have sustained, prolonged actions? Yeah, we have enough people. There's enough power to do that, but we're lacking the organization at this point. I mean, that was one thing we had, again, with the Bernie campaign, was all of these progressive organizations, all of the left, and even some of the center and some of the right, were willing to come together behind the central figurehead of Bernie, but then, you know, they cut off the head and everything went in multiple different directions. And there was no leadership. I mean, Bernie didn't even give us delegates any kind of leadership following his dropping out. Like, he basically gave us the same line he gave the press, where he was like, well, here we are. We've got these unity commissions that are going to try to move our agenda forward. And that's that. Thanks for being delegates. Go out and protest.
Yeah, unity commissions don't really do much. I think when it comes to the climate movement, as an animal rights activist, I'm very disappointed in mainstream climate organizations' refusal to advocate for plant-based diets when they know that animal agriculture is so harmful to our planet. It's a focus on energy and transportation when animal agriculture is that third rail that no one wants to talk about, because it's a combination of individual change as well as systemic, right? We need to have plant-based options in schools and hospitals and prisons, and people can make their own decisions, but we need to educate people on the environmental impacts of the choices they're making in their everyday lives when it comes to what they eat or activities they're doing. I think education is key there. And how do you feel about that?
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. I mean, I'm a big believer in everything needs systemic change. And
do you devalue individual change? Do you think it's a drop in the bucket and so it doesn't matter?
For the most part, unless you have a large enough collective group of people making these changes, it is going to be just a drop in the bucket. And I wouldn't say, you know, devaluing it so much. Like, I think people should make individual changes if they believe that that's what's going to be good for them. But I don't think it's a way to achieve systemic change is just preaching, you know, individual change is going to get us there.
Do you recognize animal agriculture's detrimental contribution to climate change?
Yes, I do recognize that. I mean, that's clearly the...
So then what would be the systemic solution other than criminalizing, I guess, animal slaughter or making it illegal, which I actually don't advocate for because even though it's a drop in the bucket, a pebble makes many ripples. And through an awakening and communication with people, maybe we can come to understand that a whole bunch of individual change can spread like wildfire. And this is I think it's both. I don't want to advocate, so I'm not blaming the individual, but we are also responsible for how we contribute in this system to an extent. Obviously, you know, people who are in a situation that does not allow them for whatever reason to buy plants or, you know, I'm not trying to blame, but I think there's a refusal to acknowledge that we also need to be a part of the solution on an individual level. And if, because what is this, it would never be accepted by society if you advocated for systemic change when it came to veganism. We're outlawing animal products. Can you imagine that ever happening?
No, and I don't think we need to do that to actually address climate change either. I mean, we can have sustainable agriculture, but the problem is that in this system, nothing's sustainable. I mean, you look, you know, like factory farms definitely should not be a thing.
Well, it's the only way to meet the demand for the society demanding so much meat consumption. There are 70 billion land animals on the planet that we feed, but there's 7 billion humans on the planet and we can't feed all of them.
We can feed them and we can transition away from a meat-based diet. But that's the thing that requires systemic change. Like, you know, if slowly we have less meat in the grocery store and people start having to buy up meat alternatives instead. And if you have a cheaper alternative, if we subsidize plant-based meats, like that could make change at a lot faster pace, I think, than just trying to educate people on an individual basis. I don't think people are going to suddenly all be out in the streets if they can, you know, can't have a hamburger every single night.
I don't know. You'd be surprised.
But I mean, if they have these, like I've had Impossible Burgers, I've had, you know, these alternatives, they taste pretty much the same to me.
I think the only way that changes then from a market, because you're advocating in this situation for a free market solution. And so that would be based on supply and demand. And so unless we get the individual to stop demanding the product by purchasing it, we wouldn't be able to create change.
Well, that's an interesting question, the free market. I mean, I don't think I'm really advocating free market, but
what are you advocating for?
I'm advocating, you know, government control of the markets to decrease meat consumption, I guess.
Would that ever happen in our system unless we had mass systemic change, given that we live in a system based on profit for shareholders?
No, it's not going to happen in a capitalist system. So like you said, yeah, there is no free market system because people are going to keep demanding, you know.
But even in socialist countries, they still eat animals. And so I don't think that addressing that problem is as simple as changing the economic solution. I think there also needs to be an education and awareness of the climate impacts of our individual choices.
Sure, I can see that. But
that's it. Sorry, I don't mean to be argumentative. It's a pet it's a pet project of mine. I would love to see the animal rights movement and the climate movement unite with the shared vision that we, you know, to save the animals, we need to save the planet, and to save the planet, we need to stop eating the animals. Like that's basic as it gets.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that needs to happen, but I just don't think that it's going to happen through just individual change on educating people. I mean, it's like people aren't going to give up their gas-based cars as long as it's a cheaper solution too. I mean, it's like, I totally agree fossil fuels are the problem, but I can't stop using fossil fuels personally. That's kind of a requirement for me to, you know, live in this society. And maybe, you know,
that's where I see the difference, because it's not required for you to eat animals.
Might not be required, but it's still actually, in many cases, still cheaper. It's going to be more expensive to switch to a plant-based diet, and being low income, it would be more of a strain.
I would argue that would be your lack of having gone into it, just because rice and beans and bananas and sweet potatoes are some of the cheapest foods you can find anywhere. Grains, legumes, and some veggies. But there's, if you're obviously, if you're getting the Impossible Burger, and if you're buying the vegan cheeses, and if you're going out for food, then it's not going to be that way. And it can be just as expensive, if not more. And I think it's the way people approach it. But this is, you might be able to tell kind of my little extra lane that I like to add on there.
It's fine. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good questions there, but I don't think we're going to achieve any of that without systemic change to the capitalist system. I mean, you talk about, you know, bananas being cheap. Well, why are bananas cheap? Because United Fruit carried out a series of coups in, you know, Central and South America with the help of the United States military to turn all these third world countries into one crop agricultural systems that is also destroying
monocropping, yeah, is horrible.
Environment. Yes. And so in pursuit of profit, once again, what we're seeing is capitalist system exploiting and destroying with no regard for the environment.
Well, monocropping is nature's picture of elevating the individual over the collective. And what we find is that in nature, it is just as destructive as it is in society.
That's a good way of putting it.
So what we need to do is just create a permaculture forest of society.
That sounds great to me. I mean, that's basically what, you know, eco-socialism, eco-communism is looking to do.
Is that your solution?
Yeah, that's definitely my solution. Yeah, eco-socialism, eco-communism, eco-Marxism, whatever you want to call it. You know, I believe that's definitely where we need to get there. The problem is, how do we get there? And that's what, you know, revolutionaries have been arguing about for the hundreds of years.
Well, I appreciate you arguing or conversing with me about it, because I think it's only through these conversations with each other, when we don't necessarily agree but can detach from our emotions in having these conversations, that we might be able to get to some shared understanding at a certain point. So,
yeah, I agree with that. We definitely need to reach some point where we're fighting for the same end. And I think a lot of people really are. It's like those basic human rights you're talking about. I think most people, even in this greed-based society, can agree that, you know, people should have food. How do we get to the point where everyone has food? Well, that's a point of contention, because as it stands, I think we're wasting something like 40% of the world's food supply anyway.
Yeah, 40% goes to food waste. 50% of all grains go to animal agriculture. 83% of all agricultural land use is specifically for animal agriculture. So that's where it's a combination of food waste and an overproduction for animals, because we still have to grow plants to feed to the animals. And so that's where the ratios come in. It's like 12 to 16 pounds of plants to get 1 pound of beef on your plate. And then we subsidize the beef and bring that to your plate for cheaper, thus perpetuating the system that is helping to destroy our planet. Well, I didn't mean to go somber there, because at the same time, I thought we were coming to some beautiful understanding in this eco-socialism. I guess, do you want to, just to like round it up, do you want to add any notes of positivity about how you might think we can create any sort of change in the future in our lives?
Well, I think, like you said, you know, education is an important part. I think people need to actually learn, you know, things like MMT, what communism actually is, rather than just buying into the whole propaganda, communism bad, capitalism good. Reading is a big part of this, but people don't want to read. There's, you know, podcasts are a good way to learn. There's plenty of ways to learn about these things without having to actually spend that much time on it. It's just, for some reason, people don't, because they're so ingrained into the system. Also, you know, there's things people can be doing as far as like unionizing. I know that's very difficult in a lot of places, and I can't blame people if they can't do it. But even talking to your coworkers about unions is a step forward from not even mentioning it at all. Whether you can actually organize a union or not is very questionable in this society. But awareness, it helps. Every little bit counts, you know? Like you said, that pebble effect, like, yes, individual change, it can count, but it needs to be on such a large scale that we can affect systemic change. And so we need that organizational basis. It's where we're working for, like, say, eco-socialism, eco-communism. And if we can get that kind of viewpoint of what the future could be without the capitalist system, future where that actually is sustainable, where we're not going to all die in a climate apocalypse, then I think that's a good step forward.
I think so too. And I really appreciate you joining me to talk about these things.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. I'd like to throw in just a few little,
oh yeah,
you know, self-promotion kind of stuff. I'm co-host of the Crawdads and Taters podcast. If anyone wants to look that up. You can find me on Twitter at Burian, on Facebook, just my name, Burian, or check out my Substack, burian.substack.com, I think is the easiest way to find that. And just appreciate it if anyone wants to look into any of those things and kind of see what I've been working on.
And I'll throw all the links in the show notes as well.
Perfect. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me again. And remember, even a pebble can create many ripples.